Oz, it's evening here, and welcome to the Watcher podcast. This is episode 6. I'm Connor, and this is Fan.
What's happening?
Well, what are we talking about?
Today, I wanted to go reach just a little bit back. I wanted to talk about gerrymandering, because I'd been thinking a lot about how much more of a historic win November would have been if the House hadn't been gerrymandered so hard.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm so into this particular subject. Yeah.
I mean, I have no numbers to back it up or anything, but with an 8% win and 40 House seats, it would seem to me that if it wasn't gerrymandered with an 8% win, it might have been 50 House seats.
Right.
Might have.
Yeah.
There's no way of telling, though, really.
Yeah, I think one of the insidious things about gerrymandering actually is that it's quite difficult to calculate how it would have looked if the districts were drawn honestly.
It is, well, you know, voter habits and all that.
Yeah.
You could make a model and predict maybe, but I doubt it would be entirely accurate.
Yeah. Well, before we jump in, can we give a couple of quick shout outs?
Yeah, that
too. One, again, this lovely music that you heard taking us in is by U235 of Luscious 235. If you go to luscious-235.com or luscious-235.com, you can make a purchase. You can buy their album, and it's out on vinyl now, which is pretty exciting.
That just came out.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And then the other thing is a longtime Twitter friend of mine and fans, who is a really good guy, Lance Cooper. He's the man behind the Save Flint Challenge. He raised $100,000 in 2018. He's been to Flint so many times, and he's contributing water, and also he's trying to find ways to pump that money into the infrastructure. He's looking to actually improve the town itself. He's an inspirational guy. He's really amazing. You can find him on Twitter at Escaped Matrix, and we'll tweet it out and stuff. But if you go there, you can find links to his GoFundMe and stuff. Please contribute if you can, and if you can't, a retweet or a share definitely counts.
Yeah, for sure. And he's a really humble, nice guy, too. Saving lives and not even taking a bit of credit for it.
Yeah, he's deep. He's very inspiring, actually. Yeah,
he really is. Like, he's the kind of person he wants to be, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering. The first thing I'd wanted to talk about was just a little bit of background on gerrymandering, because the term gerrymandering itself is actually a pejorative, meaning to inappropriately redistrict voters so that it favors one particular party or another.
Uh-huh.
The root of that word is from an old Massachusetts governor from the 1800s. I want to say maybe even the early 1800s. And he, his last name was Jerry.
It was actually Gary.
Gary, was it pronounced Gary? I'm sorry, I just read it.
No, it's actually one of those things, where we should be saying gerrymandering all this time. But anyway, yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, we like to destroy language over here, so, you know. we do, though. We do. We do a good job of it. We make it our own, like we do everything else, you know. I remember it because I remember seeing an old, like, 1800s drawing on the masthead of a Boston Gazette, I think it was, at the time. It's like a vulture-shaped district, you know.
Yeah.
It's symbolic of the fact that he had just redistricted the entire state to favor his Democratic Republican Party.
Yeah. Supposedly a rival at the time said he draws districts that look like salamanders, and somebody else said, no, it's a gerrymander.
A gerrymander.
Yeah.
There you go. Nice. So there's gerrymandering. I mean, there's legitimate redistricting that goes on after a census every time, and it's supposed to, evenly divide people up so that the voting is fair, but gerrymandering or Gary, I'm probably still going to say gerrymandering.
I'm always going to say gerrymandering. I always will, because that's the word. It doesn't matter that his name was Gary. The word is gerrymandering.
You're right. It is the word. Absolutely. Yeah. But just a little, that's like a quick primer. There's basically two ways to gerrymander a district that the legislatures, usually the legislatures draw these lines, mm-hmm. or they appoint a panel to draw these lines. This is why they can become politicized so easily.
Okay.
This is nothing new, obviously, since it's been happening since the 1800s. This has gone through the courts all the way up to the Supreme Court. And generally speaking, the courts have tried not to get involved in this process. unless there's been definitive statistical proof that something was unfair, or definitive proof that it was drawn in an unconstitutional fashion, which usually would mean violating the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
So what the key to methods that are used by the redistricting panel or legislature is what they call cracking and packing. When you're going to gerrymander, what they do is they'll take a district that might have maybe 80% Democratic voters, or 80% voters of one party would be a better way of putting that, because Democrats have done this. You know,
yeah.
This is not they engage in as much anymore, but they did used to do it just as much. As a matter of fact, Gary was a Democratic Republican, which at the time was the Democratic Party.
Right.
So okay. It was invented by Democrats when you think about it.
Yeah.
Well, it was first mythologized by Democrats, I guess. Anyway, that's not the right word either, but it doesn't matter. So,
what no, I know what you mean. It went like, yeah, it journeyed into myth because of the beginnings with the Democrats. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So they'll take a district that's primarily of one voting party, and they'll break that district up into other districts that are primarily of another voting party so that they can dilute that vote.
Okay. Yeah.
That would be cracking. Or what they'll do, because then you get a bunch of districts that are going to mostly vote for the other party, and you've spread out the voters that you don't want to vote for a particular party amongst so many districts, their votes don't count as much anymore. Oh, well, they do count as much. They just don't count as much in the district they're in anymore.
Right.
And then the other one is packing, where what they'll do is they'll take a bunch of districts that may have like a majority vote of the party that you want and then a minority vote of the party that you want, but it's just close enough that it'll be competitive. So they'll pack those voters into another district full of the party voters that you don't want from a few different districts. Thus, you'll end with like one district of the majority and then three other districts that you've created of the other majority voters. Did right. that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
There are visual aids, and I downloaded a couple that I think I may attach to the thread when we drop this so that it's easier. Maybe. I'm not sure. Probably, because I'm that way.
Right.
Well, in 2000, I think the plan was hatched in 2008. In 2008, the Republicans, who have always had a real keen interest in state governance, and a lot of it, I think, comes from their experience with the Southern Strategy, because they brought in a lot of people who had not really been part of the Republican Party. But Southern state politics is a different animal than a lot of other state politics in this country, in that the state really, really, really assumes a whole lot of power over, not over the federal government, but in kind of trying to keep the federal government away from the state's business, I guess would be the best way of putting that.
And
a lot of that comes from the Civil War, you know, like, and I think a lot of it comes from old school machine plantation politics too, because generally in the South, the state machine is run by people who are very business friendly, which would come from old plantation owner politics, in my opinion. So the Republicans knew that if they could keep control of states, they could have a huge impact on the policy making of the country without having to keep the national government all the time. And in 2008, they came up with this plan that if the census is coming and we can do well in the state houses, which draw the district lines, we can redistrict ourselves into a permanent majority, or at least a 10-year majority.
It's a chilling phrase. Yeah.
Well, it really is. It's anti-democratic. I mean, it just is. I think that gerrymandering is anti-democratic. At its core, it is.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
And then if you have an entire political party that's engaging in it as a matter of purpose, like engaging in what they know to be morally wrong, gerrymandering, you know, what they know to be anti-democratic as a party, well, then you have an anti-democratic party.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, there's no rocket science there, you know? So what they did was they hatched the plan. They said, okay, well, we're going to take over these state houses, and they poured tons of cash into state races for the 2010 election, which was the first election after Obama being elected.
Right.
So they have back wins coming. Not only do they have, well, they got a pretty good chance of doing really well because of backlash against the recently elected president, because that's how American politics generally works.
Right.
Not only do they have that, but if they put a bunch of money in, and they really didn't, and the funny thing is they didn't just dump random money into states. They were really, really smart about it and dumped it into just the right races here and there so that they could grab to make gerrymandering work and not be fought against. And it worked like a charm, man. You had the Tea Party wave of 2010, and it just, they swept the states. I think they ended up winning at least, I would say, right around 3/4 of the state legislatures and governorships.
That is scary.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, it is where it was smart. And I'm not talking about the gerrymandering part. I'm talking about, in my opinion, the Democratic Party of this country had been lax in its attention to state politics anyway.
Yeah.
And that, in my opinion, and that continued through the Obama presidency, actually, which shocked me, given that the Republicans did so well in 2010, just laying the hammer down on the Democrats, that they didn't wake up and look, oh man, we really need to start paying attention to state politics again, you know?
Yeah.
But they didn't. Like, the legislature that just did all this chicanery in Wisconsin is basically the same legislature that got elected in 2010, numbers-wise. Because they gerrymandered themselves into that majority.
Yeah.
So, the math worked out after Project Red State was successful, and it was very successful. And after it was successful, the redistricting was done by the time Obama ran for a second term. In my opinion, the only reason they held the House, because that election was actually pretty tight. As far as numbers for the House, that election was pretty tight.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I'll use Wisconsin as a model again. As a matter of fact, the most recent election in Wisconsin, this is a perfect example of gerrymandering. Almost 60% of the popular, that's not true, like 55 or 6% of the popular vote in Wisconsin went to Democrats, but Republicans still run 60% of the legislature.
Yeah, that's a classic number.
Yeah, and that's not that 60%. That's not a pull it out of my ass number. I mean, like that's the real number that the Republicans in that state for their state legislature lost huge. Like, I mean, as far as numbers go in this country, a 55% win is big in this country,
right?
Because we are so evenly divided when it comes to this kind of stuff. And If you get 55%, you've gone over that 3 or 4% that call themselves independents, and you've started to chunk into your opposition's vote. That's why it's a big deal.
Right. Right.
Those are the little numbers that electioneers look at, you know, those kinds of things. That's why sometimes they'll say 56% was a wave election, because they actually chunked into the opposing party's votes, and that's a big deal.
Okay, that's interesting, actually, because I had never heard it put that way before, and that illuminates for me. That's really good.
Well, we talked about how Karl Rove had called 51% a mandate. That was inappropriate.
56%
is a mandate. Because not only did you grab all the independents, because, you know, there's 3 or 4% of them on either side of the 50% all the time. So really you got a chunk of about 8% that are self-professed independents, you know. Uh-huh. And then if you get like 53% of the vote, 54% of the vote, well, you've brought the independents, that whole, you know, 7 or 8% of independents to yourself. And if you start chunking off over that, you know, again, you've gone into your opposing party's voting base.
Right.
So where are we at? We're talking about, oh, okay. So the success of the project was brilliant, you know, and it was a smart, if dirty and underhanded thing to do. But when I saw it happen, personally, the first thing I thought was it was going to spell their doom. And we're seeing that played out today.
Okay. I like that. Give me more.
Okay. Well, given that we had already since the 90s being moved in, being we had moved, started to move ourselves. Well, I shouldn't say that. Actually, we weren't responsible for this movement, but the political class through messaging had started to move us into tribes, opposing tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time the redistricting can, you know, it's funny. It wasn't really anything glaring to me, except for in 2010, I saw these Tea Party people, like, you know, out and about or on TV or bumper stickers, you know, and they'd say, you know, hands off my Medicare, not realizing, you know, but no socialism right next to it, you know, and not realizing that that was socialism. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It made me realize that the people that the Project Red State was appealing to, and by Project Red State, I mean, because that is part of the paying for the little districts and states and stuff, you know, that was part of Project Red State too. It wasn't just the numbers and redistricting. It was also to get the numbers for red states, you know, it was the money too.
Yeah.
I think that one of Project Red State's biggest failings was that to do what it wanted to do, it had to appeal to the lowest common denominator amongst us.
Right.
And it had to get people who were the single issues voters that you and I talked about, or it had to get the people who think they pay attention to politics, but really don't. They just listen to somebody tell them what they think about politics, you know, maybe Fox News or something.
Yeah.
And these people are not the most high information voters. So they're easy prey for somebody like Trump. So the reason that matters is because if you get a voting base that's out of step with the actual establishment of the party, it can't survive. Remember we talked about Reagan had basically was ignoring the religious right, even though he said he wasn't.
Uh-huh.
And how, generally speaking, the Republican Party has ignored the religious right on Roe v. Wade and many other issues that Donald Trump wisely did not. You know, he immediately got rid of that Johnson Amendment, or, well, tried to get around the Johnson Amendment, you know, as much as he could as an administrator. And that was smart. They'd wanted that for decades, and no president had ever done it, you know.
What is the Johnson Amendment?
The Johnson Amendment is about preachers proselytizing that's not true. It's about preachers giving out actual endorsements of candidates from the pulpit and maintaining their tax-free status.
Oh.
So it's about money.
Yeah. I mean, it's about so much money.
Yeah, it's about so much money. Because, you know, a guy like Billy Graham, or Jerry Falwell Jr. rather, can say, now he can say, hey, I want you to vote for Donald Trump. And he doesn't risk his churches at nonprofit status.
Yeah.
Because the administration has decided basically they're just not going to enforce the Johnson Amendment.
God, that's a good example of, and I don't want to take us too far down this road, but that is a good example of how huge, awful things happen and you don't notice, or I didn't notice because I'm so distracted by all the other awful stuff that I'm reading about.
Oh, yeah. Well, the funny thing is that I think most of those things that have been happening that we haven't noticed have really literally had nothing to do with Trump himself.
Right.
Like, that is totally something Mike Pence was like, and here's an executive order for you to sign, sir. Right. What is it? Oh, I mean, he probably doesn't even ask what papers he signs. I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, we've seen photographic evidence that they're blank, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I mean, so I think that, you know, like Grover Norquist said, just enough working digits to, you know, sign a bill. He's got more than he wanted, really, because he's got a guy that distracts from the bills that he's signing.
Yeah.
Like, I think maybe the worst things that one of the worst mistakes Donald Trump has made as a president, as far as like keeping his party unified, has been to start getting political. And I mean policy political on his Twitter feed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like when he started getting, quote, boring, unquote.
Okay, look, we have to allow ourselves, we've talked about this, right? We have to allow ourselves like a few minutes of a window to talk about Trump each week, because we've been like, oh, we shouldn't talk about it too much. But okay, this is our little Trump window, okay?
It's impossible not to.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the president of the United States. You have to talk about it. You
know? Yeah. So, okay, on this week's Trump window. Tell me about how Trump got boring on Twitter.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. During the election, the 2018 elections, there was a good, and I just read this a few days ago, there was a good about week or week and a half before the election, like just a period of time, not right before the election, because right before the election, it was all about fear and the caravans and, you know, what was that disease they were bringing? Leprosy or whatever. Smallpox. Smallpox, yeah.
Smallpox.
For being eradicated disease across the border, you know.
Yeah.
There was like a good, actually like a good week of time where he was extremely disciplined on Twitter and only tweeted about candidates he was endorsing. And suddenly he was boring. Why don't you know that he did that? Because it was boring. Because he wasn't a distraction.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that's one of the mistakes that he's made to try to keep his party together. And I mean, and I'll tell you why it means the whole party and not just space. Because it goes back to the gerrymandering. What the Republicans did was they gerrymandered their districts to be crazy. They gerrymandered this supremacy. They gerrymandered this religious craziness. They gerrymandered it because they knew they were their most reliable voters. So in Trump or Nunes or Gomez or any of these crazy dudes, or Gomer rather, any of these crazy dudes you hear about all the time, they gerrymandered that. They did that to themselves. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, for every action, there is reaction, my friend. You know? And if you gather all the crazies in one room, you're going to get a lot crazy out of that room.
Yeah. So is this the key point of where Project Red State leads to downfall?
That is the key point. That is the key point. They took the people who had they took the low information voters who didn't realize that their Medicare or Social Security or a VA check or whatever, or their roads even, you know, they took those people who didn't realize that that was actually democratic socialism and railed against the things that were helping them the most and crammed them all together as voters.
They encouraged the worst sailors on the ship to mutiny, and now the ship is headed for the rocks.
That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. And the funny thing is when the Tea Party movement happened, I do believe that if they had let that happen organically rather than like the Kochs jumping into it, which they did, you know, and the RNC jumped into it, and they were like, oh, we got energy here, we're going to grab it and use it so we can win these elections. If they had just let that naturally happen, we would have a completely different electorate today, I think. Because it was not the majority of the country. It was a very small minority. But because they gerrymandered it and because they made so much noise about it, they made Americans feel like that was at least a large minority rather than the small minority it was.
Not to get bogged down in conjecture, but just I find that a very interesting point about, you say, you know, it would be a very, you think it would be a very different electorate today. Can you give me like 2 minutes on what that might look like?
Oh, what the electorate might look like?
Yeah.
Well, if the Republican Party hadn't jumped into the Tea Party movement so much, they would not have won so many state legislatures, and their gerrymandering, the Red State Project, would have been less effective. Mm-hmm. And they might have ended up with someone like, I don't know, maybe Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or something, you know?
Okay.
Because it goes by districts, you know? Like, you have all these Republican districts Okay, so when a presidential candidate wants to win a primary in a given state, the districts that the voting takes place in are the same districts that the presidential election has.
Okay.
So if you've crammed all the crazy people into most of your districts and diluted all the non-crazies into the districts that really aren't going to vote for your guy anyway, then you've created this self-feeding loop of craziness. Like, one of the one of the reasons the Republican Party continues to support Donald Trump so hard, is it because they're afraid, like, a senator's not worried that he's going to lose election, a re-election in Mississippi, a Republican senator. He's not worried about that. That's a safe Senate seat. That's going to keep on Republican until there's major changes in that state, right? What the Republican senator from Mississippi is worried about is a right flank attack in the primary.
Right.
Which, by redistricting, has happened to the Republican Party more times than I can count since 2010.
And each time further to the right.
Each time further to the right. A great example of that backfiring on them, actually, would be the downfall of the majority leader Cantor. Are you familiar with this?
No.
Okay. In 2010, Eric Cantor, so in 2010, when they took over the House again, Eric Cantor, who was a Republican from, I want to say, Virginia, but that sounds wrong. No, yeah, he is, because, yeah, it's Virginia, I believe. Yeah, maybe not. It doesn't matter where he was from. He was the majority leader, you know. There's the speaker and the majority leader, you know. And he was a very Paul Ryan-esque kind of guy. Relatively well-spoken, classic conservative principles as far as like from the 80s on, I guess. I shouldn't say classic. New conservative principles. How about that? That's a better way of putting that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But he was well-spoken, was a pretty good politician, always did his job, been there a pretty fair amount of time, earned his way up to the top. And he got ousted by Dave Brat. Dave Brat ousted, I don't know what year Brat ousted him, but it was a year where the crazies started coming out on the right and primarying the crap out of Republican lawmakers, because the Republican lawmakers, even though they had power, were still ignoring their base. You know, I mean, like I said, the Johnson Amendment, Roe v. Wade. I mean, they weren't appointing judges. They weren't stopping enough judges or whatever. You know, Obama was the president, so they couldn't appoint judges. But they weren't making sure the judges, you know, like a wiser plan for the Senate, I think, would have been at the time during Obama's presidency, would have been to not stop all of Obama's nominees for the courts, but to say, no, we don't want that guy. Bring me somebody more conservative, which is how the system should have worked. You know, like Obama could have then nominated someone who was more to their liking, and they could have debated whether or not they wanted it if they had the majority, you know?
Yeah.
But they didn't. They went full on obstructionist. And I think that helped them shoot themselves in the foot, too, because as soon as the Republican House took over in 2010, really all they did was vote over and over and over and over again to cancel out Obamacare, to repeal Obamacare, even though they knew that was never going to happen. And they, for some reason, seemed to think that their base would think that that was cool and re-vote for them again. Like, yeah, man, I know you're only taking symbolic votes and you're not really getting anything done and you're just kind of trying to stick it in his eye. But things suck out here, so I'm not voting for you again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what happened. The majority leader, the sitting majority leader of the House of Representatives, got primaried out of his spot. That's insane. That doesn't happen. Why did it happen? Because they redistrict all the crazies.
And in a time of victory as well. Like
in a time of victory. You know?
Yeah.
But that makes sense. They're a greedy, corrupt party. It's never going to be enough for them. Mm-mm. And the reason I think that it's killing them is because Dave Brat was a non-knowledgeable legislator who basically just towed the party line as much as he could. The party line that he was elected on, which was the Freedom Caucus. He was a Freedom Caucus guy. And those are the leftovers from the 2010 wave who are crazy people that think that, you know, they're the ones that are the Freedom Caucus are the ones right now who won't let Trump let his wall go.
Can you give me 2 minutes on the Freedom Caucus? Because that's one of those boogeymen that I hear about all the time. And I don't really, you know, I know to associate them with stuff like what you just mentioned, but I don't really know anything about them. Can you tell me anything about them?
When the 2010 wave happened, Tea Party wave happened, the Republicans that got elected as part of that wave, the freshman Republicans, decided to form their own caucus and called it the Freedom Caucus.
Okay. Okay.
And they are the ones who got elected on don't touch my social or don't touch my Medicare, but no socialism. I mean, Jesus. You can tell what kind of legislators they are, You know, they got elected on that message. And they're the guys who say, no, we're not. They're the ones who constantly vote against disaster relief. Conservatism, you know?
You know, it really reminds me of something we were talking about recently. Unfortunately, my memory fails me, and I can't remember if we were talking about it live or if we were just chatting about it in our own, like, you know, social time. Social time is the posh name we have for when we hang out. But anyway, an unbiased media that is trusted, a voice that people go to, not for opinion, but for, oh, is this true or is that not, is so important. And in the absence of that, somebody can get elected by saying, hands off my Medicare, but also no socialism. There's no one saying, there's no one going, oh, well, let's just check and see if that's true.
There's an interesting sidebar to that. Most Americans who don't pay attention to politics as much as a person like myself or yourself or anyone who might be listening to this, because clearly people who do are into it.
Yeah.
Most Americans who are not like us, I guess would be the best way to say, as far as politics goes, they get their news from local news. And local news doesn't cover politics as much. They don't cover national politics nearly as much, like hardly ever. And they don't really consider it their job to prove the truthiness of a particular candidate that may be running in their market.
Okay. I guess that's – I had never thought about that, or I'd never really – I mean, I certainly wasn't aware of it, but that makes the whole Sinclair Media trying to take over local news and push the national political agenda thing all the darker. It makes it all the more scary.
Yeah, that's why it's such a big deal, because most Americans still get their news, the ones that get it from TV, most of them still get it from local news.
So it's virgin soil.
It's virgin soil, yeah, for state, you know, for propaganda TV, I guess. When you hear Rachel Maddow talk about, or pretty much anybody actually, talk about the death of print and why it's so important, it's because print media is even more local, and they do take it their responsibility to fact check candidates.
Okay.
So that's why the death of the American local newspaper is such a big freaking deal, because it was really the only place most Americans could find accurate, truth-based reporting about their local, state, and federal politicians.
Wow. It's interesting. Like, what will replace that? What's going to...
The internet. It already has.
What's going to happen?
It already has. Yeah, that's a worry for me. That's a big worry for me. Like, that system that was an ecosystem of information, and it's been broken. And I think that the breaking of that ecosystem, which started way back in the early Obama years, I think the breaking of that ecosystem contributed to the Republicans' ability to pull red state off. I think that. I don't, you know, it just seems logical to me that that's probably a contributing factor.
Well, it'd be a hell of a coincidence.
Well, you know, they one of my favorite phrases is correlation is not causality. I think it is.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
And I try to steer clear of assumptions because of that, because I think that's a brilliant statement, you know.
Yeah, I agree. But also, you know.
Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's easy to make that logical leap, you know?
Yeah. I think you can be, you can certainly say, like, well, I'm considering it a distinct possibility without making any pronouncements.
Yeah, which is, you know, what I never say, because I tend to make statements. No, I'm just kidding. I don't do that at all. I do try to watch what I say, you know, I tend to talk with authority when I talk, just because that's my habit. So over the years, I've tried to temper that just a little bit and, you know, not grab 99% statistic every time or, you know, 50-50 shot, that kind of thing, even though there are a lot of things that are 50-50 shot.
Yeah.
So what we have with this gerrymandering and why it has destroyed their party is that a guy like Nunes is a perfect example. They gerrymandered him. Actually, his district isn't really terribly gerrymandered because he's in California, so that's not a good example. But you can get a guy like, here's a great example, Matt Gaetz.
Oh.
Yeah, the Florida congressman. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay, well, he's like one of Donald Trump's biggest cheerleaders on television. He's a not very good communicator, which kind of strikes me as odd that he's on television so much. Mm-hmm. But he is definitely a cheerleader for Donald Trump. He's definitely in a safe gerrymandered district because it's public knowledge that his dad got him off for murdering somebody in a DUI.
Oh.
So, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, the guy is a scumbag, you know, and he got reelected.
Yeah. Wow. That's a good poster boy.
Right? But, so, you got this gerrymandering. What has ended up happening in the long run for them, here we are, what, 12 years later? No, here we are 8 years later, 9 years later, and we're just about to hit on another census. And what's happened to the Republican Party because of this gerrymandering, now that they've lost the House, is that all that's left is in their party are these really, really super gerrymandered districts. Because any district that was even close is now in Dem hands.
Oh. Yeah, okay.
So that they're going to become more extreme.
Yeah.
Because they don't have moderating voices anymore. If you were a moderate voice in the Republican Party, you're gone. And not just because of Trump. Because of the gerrymandering. Because they got primaried from the right. And so when this crazy person from the right who got there 2, 4, 6 years ago, come around to 2018 election, and everyone in the district's like, this dude's a crazy person. The people that were in the middle, the moderates, or the independents that might have been in that district, have realized I'm being represented by a crazy person.
Right.
Voter turnout goes up, Democrats get elected. That's a fact. So, but there's hope, because look at it on the other side of that. A guy like Dave Brat, who was the one who took out Eric Cantor, he did not get reelected. He said crazy, stupid things, and he's no longer in the Congress. It's in the really, really super gerrymandered districts, because Eric Cantor's district couldn't have been gerrymandered too far to the right because they were fearing what actually happened to him. That makes sense?
No. Well, no, it does, but I'm stupid. Explain it more.
Well, they know that Eric Cantor is a moderate Republican at the time they gerrymander his district. They're not going to make his district 100%.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, okay.
Crazy right-wing voters, because they'll primary him quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, incumbency is what's most important, right? The number one goal of any politician in a democracy is to be reelected. So that's what's most important. And if they... What they did was is they did gerrymander it too far, and they primaried him out. The voters primaried him out, and they had a crazy person there, a Freedom Caucus guy for X amount of years. And by the time Trumpy-Doo woke people up, the voters in that district, mostly women, actually, in that particular district, he was defeated soundly by the woman vote.
Nice.
So Red State is shooting them in the foot. In long term, it's only going to get worse, because all they have left now are the crazy people. Think about it this way. Let's say you're in a district that just swung blue, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans might be thinking to themselves, that's cool. We'll get somebody in there who can win next time, right?
Okay.
The first thing that person who they want to go through the general election, the first thing that candidate has to do is make it through the primary. Well, you got a bunch of crazy people in that district because you gerrymandered, didn't
you? Yeah.
Then your candidate's going to be another freaking neo-Nazi or something, you know? That's why they shot themselves in the foot, buddy. And that's why it's only getting worse.
Well... this has been another one of those ones where it's super dark and oddly reassuring, oddly optimistic.
I find this a very hopeful episode, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Because basically what you're doing, in my opinion, is packing all the crazies into one room and letting them be crazy in there.
Yeah.
I think that's good news for America.
That's been a good one. I love that. I love that as a point to close on, yeah.
I do too. And everybody, hey, again, thanks for listening. We love you to death. Yeah, it's we really do. So
cool. Like, we took a little break over Christmas and New Year's. And I got to say, I was really looking forward to getting back to the show. And every time a tweet came in where somebody mentioned the show or mentioned something you heard on the show or something, it made me all the more jazzed to come back. And thank you so much for that. That is so cool. That's such a privilege. I totally
got goosebumps too, man. Like, it was very, very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, anyway, so that's probably the show. We're probably done, right?
I reckon so. Thank you for enlightening me. I really enjoyed that one. All right. Well, good night, folks.
All right. Good night, everybody.